Chapter 7. Release the Billions. To understand how the federal government sent profiteers and swindlers to the races, rushing billions out the door while breaking all convention, it helps to first understand the man holding the starting gun. Consider for a moment, if you will, if you dare, the mind of Peter Navarro. Now, here's a man who gets things done. If he must, he'll do it around you, through you, in spite of you. Just ask Robert Cadlick. If he likes you, you might just like him back. Just ask Rick Bright. But the romance won't last. Just ask Rick Bright. Remember, he does not need to like you. Hell, he doesn't need to know you. If you call his cell phone, he'll tell you as much. If you called from a number I don't know, I ain't answering, he'll say in his recorded voicemail, instructing you to try a text message, which maybe you do repeatedly, only to be ignored because screw you. He's a blunt instrument, called prickly by some, worse by others. He just has that thing, you know, the thing. A persistence beyond reason, the confidence to outlast enemies and weather embarrassment, which only delusion or supernatural faith, or both, can provide. I suspect that's why Trump called him my Peter. That, and his extreme protectionist views on global trade and perceived expertise on China. He's been described in the pages of the New York Times as having a Rasputin-like ability to whisper into Trump's ear thoughts that became policy. While he was considered fringe even among colleagues in the Trump White House, from 1992 to 2001, Navarro ran as a liberal Democrat 5 times for elected office in California, failing each time. He stood next to Hillary Clinton and criticized then-House Speaker Newt Gingrich, whose rhetoric ironically paved the way for Trump's ascent and thus Navarro's appointment. A veteran Democratic consultant who ran 2 of Navarro's campaigns told the online magazine Politico that his former candidate was the biggest asshole I've ever known. And that guy presumably knows a lot of rich Californians. He's written 13 academic books, none cited by serious academics. 5 of them quote Ron Vera, a non-existent expert whom Navarro manufactured to support his arguments, with such musings as, "Only the Chinese can turn a leather sofa into an acid bath, a baby crib into a lethal weapon, and a cell phone battery into heart-piercing shrapnel." Ron Vera. It's an anagram of his surname. Get it? When academics and reporters called him out on it, Navarro acknowledged his fabrication and brushed it off, saying, as Ron Vera might say, "Lighten up and have fun reading the books." He once got in an F-bomb-laden screaming match with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin in front of Chinese diplomats. He clearly believes he's highly intelligent, and maybe he is. An assuredness he exudes not with the erudite debate skills of someone who holds a doctorate in economics from Harvard, which he does, but with the bravado of a lumbering heavyweight, which he is not, talking trash before a street fight, which he would lose. When Trump appointed Navarro to enforce the Defense Production Act and compel U.S. companies to prioritize manufacturing for the COVID-19 response, Yossi Sheffi, the director of the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, expressed disbelief. "We have some of the largest companies in the world who are running global supply chains and have contractor relationships all over the world," Sheffi told Mother Jones magazine. "There are literally thousands of them. Any of them would be doing a better job than a crackpot economist." I would not deign to such hyperbole, as I've never met Navarro, nor do I claim to be an economist, crackpot or otherwise. Also, because I appreciate Peter Navarro for what he is. A uniquely American specimen. He's the Nicolas Cage of modern politics. Unhinged, but not always off his mark, beholden only to himself, amused by his own stunts. He might be fun to get a drink with, until maybe he isn't. I'd take my chances anyway. But unfortunately, Navarro did not respond to several attempts to reach him. I suppose it is the tragedy of him that most fascinates me. Congressional records, emails, and interviews with people who were in the room show that Navarro came close to becoming something of a hero in this particular story. Instead, he was Peter Navarro. While the Trump administration was slow to establish a clear national effort to shore up supplies, Navarro was waging his brand of guerrilla warfare behind the scenes, starting with a March 1st email to Trump and other senior officials. Since the first news from China of a viral epidemic, I forecast a significant global pandemic. Over the last month, I have presented the task force with action memos to combat the virus swiftly in Trump time. But movement has been slow. There is no downside risk to taking swift actions as an insurance policy against what may be a very serious public health emergency. If the COVID-19 crisis quickly recedes, the only thing we will have been guilty of is prudence. Navarro's antics had lost him credibility in a White House whose credibility was tenuous at best. But he was right. He got a lot of things right. In that memo, he recommended that a small White House team coordinate to gather up therapeutics that might run dry if supply chains congested. He urged the president to direct the VA, HHS, CDC, and Commerce to identify current hospital system, wholesaler, manufacturer, pharmaceutical, and agricultural inventory levels and surge production capacity of essential generic medicines. He raised fears that a vast array of imported drugs peripheral to treating patients, such as sedatives for those placed on a ventilator, could disappear if the United States didn't ramp up domestic drug manufacturing quickly. He called for more funding at HHS and BARDA, faster development of testing, faster testing itself. He noted that a vaccine was many months away and urged the administration to explore and invest in companies that had potential treatments on hand or in the works. He recommended the government get behind Regeneron's monoclonal antibodies, a cocktail of synthetic antibodies that could theoretically help COVID patients recover, based on its use in treating other ailments. He mentioned remdesivir, a promising antiviral developed by Gilead Sciences that some, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, believed could be useful in treating infected patients. In some cases, there is already some movement, but the movement is not fast enough, Navarro implored. In his exuberance, however, Navarro crossed lines that most scientists and serious public health officials would not. He advocated for remedies, drugs, and companies that hadn't been vetted. At the same time, he listened to Bright at BARDA. He kept the counsel of Stephen Hatfill, author of 3 Seconds Until Midnight, which he revered as a sort of pandemic Bible. Navarro also did his own ad hoc research, which included talking with companies vying for government cash. The result was a muddled message that contained real and dire warnings, as well as a sort of high-stakes gamble on unknowns and contingencies in the name of prudence. A key figure in preserving our national well-being was, in essence, throwing ideas at the wall to see what stuck. Navarro was frustrated with the pace, so he did something cunning and historically remarkable. He took federal purchasing into his own hands. Throughout the month of March and into late spring, Navarro steered hundreds of millions of dollars to companies, working around career contracting professionals with blatant disregard for the formal channels meant to weed out fraud and corruption and ensure the government gets a decent deal. Tried and true processes developed after the spoils of the Civil War, fine-tuned through economic downturns and the advent of the military-industrial complex, refined after disasters like Hurricane Katrina, all of it was thrown out the window. To stock up on medicines and the components needed to make them, referred to as active pharmaceutical ingredients, or API, Navarro used his position and his bluster to award a first-time government contractor a $354 million contract, with options that could have paid out as much as $812 million over a decade. The company, Flow, had incorporated just months before, in January 2020. But its CEO, Eric Edwards, had met Navarro as early as the fall of 2019. It made sense that Navarro would know folks in the domestic pharmaceutical space, given his belief that China's dominance of pharma supply lines could one day kill us all. Edwards was best known for helping launch the controversial drug company Kaleo, which marketed an anti-allergy injection pen to compete with the EpiPen. Kaleo's first epinephrine delivery device failed after it was pulled from shelves due to safety concerns, though it returned a couple of years later. Kaleo is also known for price gouging on a powerful opioid antidote at the height of the country's deadly rash of opioid deaths, raising the price of the drug from $575 a dose to more than $4,000 in 3 years. Edwards moved on to a new venture, and as news of the coronavirus spread in February 2020, the company reached out to its valuable contact in the Trump White House, according to emails unearthed in a later congressional inquiry. With Navarro's help, the company landed a meeting with BARDA officials in which it solicited a strategic API reserve, a stateside factory of compounds that can be made to cook up various drugs as needed. After the meeting on March 20th, Navarro wrote to BARDA director Bright an extraordinary directive that, in sane times, aspiring government contractors could only dream of. "My head is going to explode if this contract does not get immediately approved. This is a travesty. I need Flow noticed by Monday morning. This is being screwed up. Let's move this now. We need to flip the switch and they can't move until you do. Full funding, as we discussed." A week later, annoyed with the lack of movement, Navarro went around Bright to several key officials, including DOD officials, Admiral Polovchek, and Cadillac at HHS. "Flow needs to get greenlit as soon as humanly possible. It is a critical part of our advanced manufacturing strategy at the White House. Please move this puppy in Trump time," Navarro wrote. "I'm on it," Polovchek replied. "Yes, we need that contract." If the influence peddling wasn't already obvious, a consultant helping Flow land the deal told its CEO to keep Navarro fuming. "CCing Navarro cranks up the pressure," the consultant advised. Hadfield, at this point Navarro's brain trust, helped negotiate the contract awarded to Flow. This is remarkable because Hadfield did not work for or represent the federal government in any way. He was an adjunct professor at George Washington University, a private school, who frequently talked on the podcast by Steve Bannon, who just happened to be an ardent advocate of an anti-malarial drug called hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID. Hadfield was given office space in the White House, where he coordinated with high-ranking officials and bragged to friends that he worked an average of 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, unpaid, as the senior medical advisor to one of the president's senior advisors. "He was a force in pushing the administration's obsession with hydroxychloroquine," records show. At the same time Navarro and Hadfield worked out the Flow deal, Navarro's team was also trying to secure a $765 million loan to Eastman Kodak, the photography company, to help produce hydroxychloroquine. The company showed interest but had no experience doing such a thing, so after a few months of back and forth, nothing would come of the Kodak moment. But the drug itself would be immortalized by Trump, Navarro, and others, who dangerously and falsely hailed hydroxychloroquine as a miracle drug. Navarro's advocacy for the drug, in fact, would soon place him at odds with his new pal, Bright. I'll reserve judgment on Navarro's actions, except to say they did break the rules, and there were major consequences to throwing money around so willy-nilly. His personality and anti-China fanaticism blurred the lines between what might have been well-intentioned rule-breaking and outright patronage and corruption. Still, I strain to argue that there is no higher morality than the arcane rules laid out in the Federal Acquisition Regulation, or FAR, as purchasing people know it. This was a crisis, and America will do what it does in any crisis: throw money at it. So, perhaps some rogue actions were warranted. We needed stuff, and we needed it fast. And for better or worse, Navarro, with all his eccentricities, was the guy doing something about it. The aforementioned contracts and the machinations behind them wouldn't be made public until about a year into the pandemic. But there was another deal that Navarro, with Hatfill and some other connected people, cooked up that slipped through the administration's smokescreen in early April. And I just happened to find it. He had just given me more than a year's worth of stories. I went into lockdown on March 10th, 2020, a few weeks before much of the country, after learning that someone at a journalism conference I had attended in New Orleans was sick. The Crescent City was at the beginning of its first major outbreak following the close-quarter Mardi Gras festivities. I am ashamed to admit I hadn't taken the coronavirus as seriously as I should have until that night, when I got the email from ProPublica's president that anyone who attended the conference could not return to the office. In that moment, what felt like an abstraction, a far-flung virus that some said was kind of like the flu, sharpened into a call to action. It was my oh-shit moment. It was now clear this virus would be a major news event, and I needed to find my place in the coverage. Sometime that week, much of the ProPublica staff joined a conference call in which we laid out some reporting lanes to cover the virus and its impacts. I was assigned to a large team that would delve into the deaths. In a moment of eerie prescience, one editor told the group, "Poor and minority people are going to get totally screwed." I will never forget it. So, through March, we gathered death records and data from cities across the country to see what trends we could find. The best data came out of Chicago, Milwaukee, and Miami. To our profound disappointment, the theory held true. The virus was ripping through Black and Hispanic communities, disproportionately taking lives and destroying families. I crunched some of the earliest data in Chicago, mapping out where those who died had lived and overlaying it with census data that broke down neighborhoods by income and race. The contrast was as stark as it was heartbreaking. This line of reporting would not stop, at ProPublica and elsewhere, as the virus exploited the deep institutional racism and inequality of our healthcare and social systems, and laid bare the contemporary consequences of our historic and enduring sins. It was the most important story. But I had begun to feel like dead weight, as reporters more qualified and frankly better at covering race and science eclipsed my contributions. So, as a member of a very new reporting team in Washington, and seeing the frenetic pace of developments at the federal level through March, I switched gears for what amounted to a less emotionally taxing but foundational journalistic pursuit: following the money. On March 27th, Trump signed into law the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. The CARES Act unleashed $2.2 trillion in stimulus relief and spending. Among many initiatives, it authorized rare direct welfare in the form of $1,200 to most single Americans, subsidies to keep small businesses afloat, and more than $100 billion in spending for hospitals and supplies. To citizens and business owners, it represented a lifeline. To aspiring profiteers, the new money and the president's authorization of emergency no-bid spending meant opportunity. By the first week of April, transactions from the first wave of COVID spending were added to a massive public-facing federal purchasing database. My colleague, Derek Willis, a data journalist who had spent ungodly amounts of time with this data over a long career, jumped on it. Together with a group of reporters, we spliced up hundreds of thousands of lines of data and queried for trends outliers, and totals. Reviewing contracts might sound on the surface like the most boring endeavor imaginable. But starting all the way back to my amateur muckraking days at Colorado State University, I had developed a nose for finding explosive stories hidden between the legalese and in the footnotes. There is always a story in government contracts. Always. We noticed potential stories right away. First, the delivery timelines for many of the contracts involving PPE, hospital beds, and testing equipment extended well into the summer and the fall. This meant that, despite what the Trump White House would have Americans believe, the executive branch was preparing itself for a long slog well into 2020. Or worse. Money talks. This was existentially depressing, but we needed more to craft a story. Next, we did some standard categorizations, placing chunks of data into what we call buckets. When we grouped by total agency spending, the Department of Veterans Affairs stood out, as did Cadillac's office at HHS, ASPR. It stood to reason that these agencies would be the big spenders. ASPR was central to the pandemic response, and the VA oversaw the nation's largest hospital system. But when we narrowed the totals to just contracts awarded without any bidding, the VA jumped out especially. In just the initial gusher of contract awards, the VA awarded something like $365 million in emergency awards, much of it for PPE. They were freaking out. We doubted the agency could have done much, if any, due diligence on that many awards in so little time. From there, we dug deeper into the granular data to examine the vendors being paid. Following the same process, grouping, totals, sorting, drilling down, we could see the vendors who landed the largest paydays and those who did so without any bidding. In general, data can point you in the direction of the story, which one must next unearth through sourcing, paper records, and going out into the field. Federal purchasing data is limited on qualitative detail, such as, crucially, describing what the damn contract is actually for and why it was awarded. Gathering what clues we could required reading line by line by line. Luckily, we'd filtered down to our buckets and made some top-level targets. We split up what was now a few hundred rows apiece and started picking through spreadsheets. That's when I stumbled on the Easter egg Navarro had unwittingly left me. The single largest no-bid contract at the time was a $96.4 million deal that FEMA awarded to the American subsidiary of a Canadian defense contractor called Airboss of America, which made various things out of rubber. It was for the production of powered air-purifying respirators, or PAPRs, those full-faced hoods that actively filter to make breathable air, as seen worn by hazmat teams and Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak. In the cell describing why the contract was awarded without bidding, someone had written, "ordered by the White House." That was odd. These descriptions are by design almost always too short or lacking enough detail to be interesting on their own. I wondered if some smart, lower-level contract official added it to CYA, cover your ass, to ensure auditors would later know who was responsible. I ran a few queries in the larger purchasing data and found no other instance of that wording. It was an outlier. The White House, a political office, is not supposed to single-handedly order payments to private businesses, for obvious reasons. So we had a story. A couple of days later, a colleague and I published the story confirming that the White House had taken the extraordinary step of ordering agencies what to buy and from whom. Trump and his men were writing enormous checks without any real vetting or oversight. What could go wrong? But why did the White House order this specific deal? We had two theories. Either the government was so desperate and clueless that it was doling out checks like Oprah gives out cars, or there was some type of old-school corruption afoot. Or both. We looked under what rocks we could and notice some loose connections between the company's leadership and people adjacent to Kushner. But it was all innuendo that amounted to nothing. We had to let it go. And I'm glad we did. We wouldn't learn for about a year that the contract was directed by Navarro with help from Hatfield. All it took for the company to land the deal was a second-degree connection to Navarro and an email with a price quote. When the company emailed its price for 100,000 of its high-end respirators, Navarro, who had no authority to approve contracts, simply ordered it done. "This will be sent forthwith for swift approval up the chain and consider it done," he said. In normal times, a deal of that magnitude would take many months to complete. But Navarro did it in 2 days. When the company announced its deal with FEMA in a press release, it included a quote from Navarro that read, "This is war, and President Trump is using the full force of the federal government and the full power of private enterprises, like Airbus." The next week, the parent company's stock price doubled. The company would almost triple its sales volume, thanks in large part to Navarro, and see a $12 million increase in profit from April to June 2020. As Ron Vara might say, God bless America.